Welcome back, everyone, to episode number 2. I hope you got to know Dr. Felt a little bit through his words in episode 1, through his story. I'm very excited to bring to you episode 2, where he focuses less about himself and more about the clinical aspect and the clinical insight that he has for those of us who have someone in our lives who we're trying to guide and work with in ADHD. Hope you enjoy this episode and these insights. Feel free, as always, to share feedback, thoughts, questions, and I'm looking forward to continuing this series together.
Welcome. My name is Yechiel Bressler, Assistant Director and Therapist at Upward Community. You're listening to Mental Health Matters, the podcast where we do a deep dive into the mental health challenges confronting the Orthodox Jewish community. Join us as we identify, explore, and open up the conversation about some of the biggest struggles facing our community today.
Welcome back, Dr. Felt. Thank you for joining us for yet another episode. Thank you. And for today, we actually have a special co-host, Rifki Greenland. Thank you for joining us on this episode.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to start with a quick myth buster. What are the three biggest myths about ADHD?
I'm so glad you asked. One of them is this idea that ADHD is not real and all you need to do is step it up. It is very real. It's like super, super real. In fact, I still remember the horror of staying at someone's house, very well-respected mechanic, and he's like, you do ADHD? I didn't realize that was something beyond school. And for most people listening here, I am assuming they would share the same collective outrage of, are you serious? Not just something like this. Like, you realize how mad my wife gets at me over like the dumbest ADHD things, or how like my self-esteem is shot because I just never was able to do the same things that everyone else was able to do, or how a Sephardian mother is just like, how the heck does everyone else manage having, you know, jobs and kids and husbands and PTA and all that? Like, are you out of your mind? School? Halavai. Halavai it ended at school. Baruch Shepatrani. That would have been amazing. ADHD is not just a school thing. It's not a made up thing. It's not a bad parenting thing. It's a real thing. I have a family member who said, I thought ADHD is just bad parenting. Honestly, those parents are really probably super parents because they're like really trying their absolute best and they've been dealt a very, 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 very bad hand. Well, not bad, but a much more challenging hand than everyone else. And they're probably trying to parent way more than the average parent of three of like the regular delicious kids who show up, go to school, come back and have the normal little silly fights, you know, and just the same old fetching on homework and this and that, not having to deal with kids who are like ripping apart their siblings, you know, rooms and stabbing each other with scissors and burning houses down. Like, yeah, it's definitely not a parenting thing. I think that the parents of kids with ADHD are really trying their hardest. Someone just told me a great line she saw in the beginning of a book, which was that behind every successful kid with ADHD, it's a really, really tired parent.
I think that's what parents with any child who has any challenges.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So what is ADHD then?
All right. So if it is a real thing, what is this real thing? And I'm happy to share. It's actually kind of confusing in the sense that it makes sense why people would be confused about it. But at its core, it's pretty simple, which is it's a different operating system of the brain. It means that while, like, let's say regular neurotypical brains are interested by what's important or what's beneficial, the neurodiverse brain doesn't. That's not really a part of the equation. In fact, life would be so much easier if they just like focused on, right? Imagine if every brain was just attracted to what's important or what's beneficial. Things would get done, right? Everything would be orderly and it would make sense. You would do the things that just make sense. So that would be awesome, except that what if your brain doesn't work that way? What if your brain operates on only one motivating factor, interest? Is this interesting or not interesting? It doesn't matter if right now it's really, really important for me to do my taxes, or if right now, like, there's a huge prize the Rebbe is going to give for all the kids who chazer the Gemara on Matzah Shabbos during Avos Subhanim, right? It doesn't matter. If it's not interesting, or if it's not nearly as interesting as playing Madden with my friends, it ain't going to happen.
Can I ask a question?
Please.
What's the science behind that? You know, why, what is going on in a ADHD brain that's not going on in a typical brain?
Really, really good question. So the answer to that is really a very popular word called dopamine receptors, which is that for people like the neurotypical brain, they have a much more balanced dopaminergic receptor uptake, which is that their brain is easily stimulated by things that give them a dopamine release. Meaning, if you think about it, we're all basically dopamine junkies. When I was a little kid in yeshiva, we used to have this little game on get this, ready, blast from the past, Palm Pilots, where we would play, it was called Dope Wars. It was about like drug dealers, and I don't know why they let that in yeshivas, they probably didn't. But we're basically all dope dealers, right? We're all running around trying to get our dopa hit. And just for a neurotypical brain, it's a lot easier. Like a shear is actually very stimulating for a dope, like for a regular neurotypical brain, and they're getting the dopamine release and they're feeling happy, right? Dopamine's our happiness neurotransmitter. It's what makes us feel good. You get that when you eat chocolate, you get that when you play games, you get that when you buy a dress on sale. That's what is rushing through your brain. So that's really the key here is dopamine. A neurodiverse brain, right? Like let's say an ADHD brain, it has a much higher threshold for dopaminergic release, which is that it needs a much higher level of stimulus to release that same dopamine. So that means that during the same lecture, right, there'll be the girl with ADHD looking out the window or noticing, I wonder what kind of necklace she's wearing. Oh, that's cute. I think I saw that once on sale, right? Because the speech itself wasn't stimulating enough to release the dopamine that her brain is looking for more dopamine. And that's what everyone's doing, meaning she's no different than the woman sitting right next to her taking copious notes because that person's dopamine is being stimulated and released by just the beauty of the Torah that's being shared. But the person with ADHD, it's just not enough. It's just not doing it for her. And therefore, she's looking for the same dopa release, but she's not getting it from just the sheer.
I actually have two questions on that. The first one is, what's the pathology in terms of why one brain is different than the other? Why one brain is going to have ADHD, you know, not as much dopamine or dopa merger?
Shame, she'en, shnei, partzufin, daimen, zulazo, kain, ain, leave, adam. It's like, it's just not, there's two, ain, shnei, deos. There's no two deos, really. There's, everyone's brain is different. We're kind of born this way.
Is it like brain chemistry? Is it genetic? Is it?
Oh, it's totally genetic and 1,000% brain chemistry. It's 60% hereditary in the sense that if one of your parents have it, you have a 60% chance of getting it yourself, right? Or out of four kids, right? That means probably three out of those four will probably have it, right? Or if your grandfather had it or your grandmother had it or one of those people had it, like then you're at an elevated likelihood to be blessed with those same qualities.
Is there any study that suggests that Jews have more, you know, or...
I don't know. It's all anecdotal. So thanks for asking. I'm not sure.
And my other question to you was, so you were talking about the, you know, the nice lady in cheer who's listening and she's taking notes and she's just doing great because she's getting her dopamine from that. But what about the person who is listening and is not interested in that, but doesn't have ADHD? It's not like everybody who goes to a cheer is sitting down and interested and is okay. Like you either are or are not interested. It's not like if you don't have ADHD, you'll sit down at any shear and copiously take.
I don't know if this is what Rifki was asking or if this is what I'm asking in addition to what Rifki is asking, but are you suggesting that anyone who is inattentive for a period of time has ADHD?
Wow. Thanks for asking it that way. No, that would be preposterous. Not at all. In fact, I think it's important for me to clarify that the difference in the two brains is that one is motivated by things that are important, i.e. any shear that they deem to be important, or beneficial. Hey, I want to get a good grade on this. So even if I'm stuck listening to Rebetzin, whatever her name is, in my school meeting room thing that I'm not interested in, I'm not part of a self-selecting sample that decided to schlep out in the middle of the windy cold to listen to some shear at a shul 2.5 blocks away, but I'm stuck in school being forced to listen to something. But if I know that I'm going to be tested on it or that the prince, the mechaneches are walking around making sure that I'm taking notes or that I'm paying attention, then it's in my best interest. It's beneficial for me. And therefore, I am motivated to do it. But if you have someone who doesn't have those two motivations, such as right the importance or that it's beneficial to them, then that's not going to help.
And what about a person who is interested in a shear, let's say something like that, who would be, you know, that motivates them, but they have ADHD, and why aren't they getting the dopamine just from the shear?
Well, it depends. If they're interested, they're in. Interest is very different than want. They may want to listen to the shear, but if it's not interesting, not going to do it.
Meaning, so you're getting that rush of dopamine, which is essentially what you're saying, right?
I wouldn't call it a rush. It's the same dopamine you're getting, Yechiel. What, aren't you getting dopamine from doing this?
Obviously. But right, you're going to get the release of dopamine by whatever that interest stimulates, that dopamine. Right. So that then becomes a hyper focus, right, on whatever you are interested in.
If you have hyper attention, then yeah, you would be hyper focused. If you're not hyper attention, then you just I'm saying it's interesting, so you'll pay attention.
This really resonates what you're saying, because I am that person. You know, I used to tell people, like, I don't like to go to Shearim. And they would be like, what are you talking about? You don't like to go to Shearim? How could you not like Shearim? And they didn't understand, like, what's wrong with you? And I would say, I don't like to be talked at, you know? And it's like, and, you know, and people really could not understand, like, what is wrong with you? Can't go and listen to a Shear? And I'd be like, unless it's a workshop and I'm participating, I cannot listen to a Shear. It's very, very difficult for me. Or unless it's something that's so super interesting to me that, like, it really has me. And I will be that person who will listen for a minute and then start looking around at, like, what else I want to focus on. So I just wanted to, you know, full circle, go back to what you were saying. Are you saying that, let's say a person like me would be searching for that dopamine because I'm not just getting it from the Shear. So I'm going to go look for something else. I'm going to go find an interest, you know, whether it's a, you know, something I found on my hand or, you know, something that's on the ground or someone's pair of shoes. And I'm going to start focusing on that. And then I'm going to go to Amazon and then I'm going to look it up and then I'm going to research it. And like, that's where my dopamine is coming from because it's not coming from the Shear.
And you see how people would just call that distractibility or inability to focus. It's not. You're focusing ganz fine on that pair of shoes and going through all those reviews, processing and analyzing all that information at rapid speed. And you're actually doing some pretty great brain work there, just not on a Shear.
Right. It's so interesting because it's so misunderstood because people say, well, they have an inability to focus, but that's absolutely not true. They have an unbelievable ability to focus on what they want to focus on.
Exactly.
So hold on a second here. This is the ADHD hyperactive type, right? But isn't there also an ADHD inattentive type?
There is, but the most common one is combined. So.
But then what does it mean inattentive?
That they're just not focusing at all because they're not, is that because they're not looking for the dopamine rush or?
They are, but again, they also, it's not enough. Most things aren't giving them enough of the dopamine release that they're not, it's just not giving it to them. So they're constantly searching for it. So it comes across to the uninformed observer. It looks like this person's just really distractible.
So the hyperactive type is seeking the dopamine through hyperactivity.
Yeah.
And the inattentive type is seeking the dopamine through a...
Inactivity.
Inactivity or inattentiveness, right? Meaning
through... Well, it comes across as inattentive, but they are attentive to what's interesting.
Right. They're still paying attention to what's going on in their brain. They're just not paying attention to the classroom. They're inattentive to what you're saying, but they're not blank in their head. There's something going on there. Is that right?
Yeah. The biggest takeaway, it seems like I'm hoping for you, Yechiel, is that ADHD is not an inattention disorder.
Right.
Because it's not about inattention. It's really about the fact that you just can't observe what's really, you can't interest me well enough to get my attention. So it's more of like a attention hard to get it-ism.
It's like a, you better be interesting or I'm not listening to you, but if you are, I am super attentive.
It's a attention hard to get. Yeah.
Fascinating, very insightful. And now I'm a parent with a kid with ADHD.
And you know that your kid isn't broken.
Well, first you have to let them know that they're not broken because I don't know that that's even understood enough by parents.
It won't be. It's not understood even if you tell it to them. Because you need to believe it. If you don't believe it in your core, then you're still going to be, it's going to come across as fake. Like, do you really think I'm not broken? Then how come you're always getting annoyed at me?
Because I feel like with education, with the right psychoeducation, even with your children, to be able to say, you know how you focus on drawing and you can draw tiny little, you know how you do that? That shows that you do know how to focus. I just want you to understand, or you know when you're playing baseball and you're laser, like that shows that you absolutely, so don't let your teachers tell you you don't know how to focus. You know how to focus. You just are focusing on the things you're interested in. And I think that would speak volumes to kids.
Yes, it would.
But also, hold on, I'm gonna challenge what you just said of Echa B'Pecha believe that just because you're telling me that I can focus and because you're telling me that I can do it and you still get annoyed at me must mean you don't believe it. But to me, that's not true. I'm a parent. I'm a human being. It's hard. It's hard, no? When a kid is distractible, when a kid isn't focused, so a parent could believe that they're not doing it intentionally or maliciously and still lose patience.
I was going to say, parents lose patience all the time. You know what I'm saying? Like, parents lose patience with lots of things. But I think if we understand what this is, then we can help ourselves to have more patience with our kids. Because we're not saying, what is my kid's problem? We're saying, oh, I get it. They're just not interested in what they're doing. Let's refocus that, or let's teach them a different way, or let's show it to them in an interesting way that they'll be, you know, or let's focus on the things that they are successful at. And then you won't have to get so frustrated. And I hope that parents get it.
Amen. And rebam. Because really, and I made this point in the last one, Yechiel, which is that I don't even like using the label of ADHD. And I don't tell parents to tell the Rebbe, oh, my kid has ADHD, because I feel like then the Rebbe's stuck with their primitive label or whatever their label is, maybe a very advanced label. But the point is that they view your child still through that lens of whatever they think of ADHD. And that's not fair to our child, because our child is a human being and they're a special person with or without the diagnosis. And they cannot be confined to a diagnosis or to a bunch of words in like 7 pages in a DSM. Our child is so much more than a diagnosis.
What do you say to Rebbeim when you have to explain that your kid has ADHD, but you don't want to use those words?
I say that my kid's really, really bright and can be super, super engaged if you could pull him in.
Smart.
I put the ball in their court. You do your job, Rabbi, and I'll do mine.
Is that a reasonable expectation of our Rebbeim?
Yeah, that's such a wonderful question. What is the expectation of our Rebbeim? I guess it would be maybe like what we say in the morning, Baruch atah Hashem, Elokeinu Melech Haolam, right? That we say this very beautiful bracha every day, right? That Asher Baruch Rabbeinu Kol Amim, Asam Lanus Teraso, right? And then that he teaches us Torah, right? The Harev Na Hashem Elokecha is the Reis HaRasecha, right? To teach it to us, to make it sweet, to make it loving, to make it fun.
And I think I know the answer to this, but I want to ask your opinion anyway. If you know that your child is like that, proactively, when they're going into their, you know, 7th grade, 8th grade, did you have a conversation with the Rebbe beforehand saying, before you meet my kid, I need you to understand something about them, so that by the time it gets to parent-teacher conferences in November, you're not, like, you're, the teacher already understands, the Rebbe already understands.
So I'm a huge fan of prepping, huge fan. It's a delicate balance. You have to know the Rebbe, the reputation of the Rebbe beforehand. I'll tell you one thing I definitely do, no matter what. I always send the honey cake on Rosh Hashanah. And I always send a basket of overflowing, like, chveis pomegranates or whatever for the Rebbe's wife, right? And stuff like that. So I think that's number one, is to develop an alliance so you can be a team, that you're working together. And to be very open, right? Hey, call me if there's anything that's going on. You know your job really well. Like, you know how to teach Gemara really well or Chumash really well. And I know my kid really well. Together, we could make this really awesome.
So here's the question. You have a teacher. He's boring. Or she's boring. The kid is no way focusing, and they're not getting rid of the teacher, right?
Great question. I deal with this every day.
So what does a parent do, knowing all of this information, and this is how my kid is, and my kid needs to be interesting, and you can't just wave a magic wand and say, be interesting, right? So what do you do?
Well, you could give them a magic pill. The magic pill will make it easier for their brain to get dopaminergic release, which is good, but again, that doesn't help everything. And so really, because pills don't teach skills, you may have to help your child develop the skill of manufacturing their own interest. Whoa, what is that? So manufacturing your own interest really takes one step back at what is interest, right? What are the active ingredients of interest? You know who knows? Marketing execs. Let's ask those guys. And you know what they break it down into? And as I say it, they'll probably be very familiar to many people here listening, because you've seen this all over in advertising, right? Which is 4 ingredients. CNUs of manufacturing interest are challenging or competitive. Collect all 6. And then there's new or novel, right? New design, right? New ownership or something, right? Urgency, call now. First 3 callers will get the, right? Or on sale now for limited time, right? And then they're stimulating, right? Where the S is stimulation. So you'll see like the big bright lights, or like how clearance tags are always a bright red or something like that. Yeah, they know what they're doing, these guys, right? And they make billions of dollars off of us and our brain every single year. So, hey, why not use some of that? We're paying for it anyways, right? Let's use some of that science for ourselves.
So can you take us through an example there? Like, what you got a kid, right, who's struggling to focus in class. So, yes, okay, the Rebbe should be more interesting, right, to engage them. Let's say it's not. Right. And now you're saying, okay, so then the fix essentially is, you know, okay, maybe medication, maybe not medication. Again, we can get into that conversation. But now you're saying, on top of that, the job of the parent is now, how do you help that child create more CNUs?
Exactly. And I want to put a plug for medication, only because I have so many adults who sit here, parents who sit here in my office on that couch and say, I wish I had, my parents had given me medication earlier, crying in tears. They're crying in my office saying, my life, imagine how much different my life would have been. How I wouldn't have had to hate myself and think that I'm a broken, dumb idiot.
So should we go down the medication road?
I just bring it out there. And we want to make sure that people know you're really, really, really doing it's a tough Nisayan to go through. And I know that a lot of people are concerned. Folks, you take medicine for everything else, right? Why the heck not this? This medication has been around for 100 years, right? It's really great stuff. It works. It's not addictive. I'll prove it to you. How come you have to keep reminding them to take it? You ever had someone be a crack cocaine? Oh, it's 3 o'clock. Totally forgot to take my crack cocaine. Like, come on, right? It's not addictive. In fact, it significantly increases the likelihood of your kid not going to one of those gateway drugs to numb the pain of feeling like a loser, and significantly increases their long-term productivity, their self-esteem, their sense of self, and their ability to learn to be a Talmud Chacham. Anything beautiful that you told them about or that they read about in those Gedolim books, medication can make it easier for them to be that person. It's really a beautiful gift to be able to give to your child and to have the gvura to overcome your own anxiety, to research it, do it right, and realize it really is a game changer. It's been around for a long, long, long time. Talking to reputable physicians that you trust with your heart medication, that you trust with all your other stuff, right? And maybe try to find some place where you could see what's really in my way. What's really blocking me? Is it that I'm embarrassed my kid needs it? Is it that I feel like I failed as a parent and that's why I can't give them medication? It's a very, very sticky.
You know what it is?
No, tell me, Rivki, what is it?
I think a lot of it has to do with shiduchim. And if I put my kid on medication, I have to tell the shadchan my kid is on medication. I think that is the number one reason why.
I love that you brought that up. You know why? You want your kid to reach a madriga where there's someone that people want to read shiduchim to? Maybe you should consider getting the medication. Number two is ADHD is the worst kept secret in the world. I remember agonizing over when am I going to tell the girl I'm dating that I'm on meds. And you know what? Already on after the first date, she Googled ADHD and asked her aunt, who's a special ed teacher, all about ADHD. And I was sitting there agonizing over here, sixth date, seventh date, asking my Rebbeim. She knew right away, it's not a secret. And if you're, come on, you really think that no one else noticed? Come on.
I completely agree with you. And I'm all about meds for everything that a person can benefit from, whether it's ADHD or anxiety, depression. I think that all of those things should be on the table, but not just shiduchim for you, but I think parents are worried for themselves. Like if I put my kid on medication, and I know this from my own clients whose parents were hesitant, then a parent once actually said this, it'll be a prison sentence for life.
Hold on a second though. I'm all for, going through the process. I'm all for, medication. When people need it, it can be a life changer. It can be a life changer, obviously, as you said. But parents, there are a lot of parents who are legitimately concerned. There are a lot of parents. There are clients I've seen, just in my experience, it doesn't always work for everyone.
Ooh, so if the parent already tried meds and it didn't work, that's a different parent, right? This is a parent who's already bit the bullet, who's looking at it straight in the eye with truth, sincerity, and a deep desire to do what's best for the kid. Yeah, you're right. Sometimes medication doesn't work. It's very rare. It works in over 85% of the time. It works for stimulants, help children get that dopaminergic response. It releases the dopamine in the brain so that they can sit through the same shear and get as stimulated by whatever this beautiful speaker is talking about as the person next to them.
And what about the argument or the question, the concern that the parents have that this is my kid, and this changes their persona, their personality, etc. I've heard that also.
Oh, I love that question. Oh, it changes their personality. Yeah, yeah, it might.
But it doesn't.
I'm saying if the kid turns into a zombie, they're on too high of a dose. So go lower. That's number one. Number two, yeah, till then, he's going to be that crazy kid, right? Or the girl who always says stupid things. Yeah, it might change their personality. Grab it, run!
And how, aside from this podcast, which is going to be widely listened to, really, it's going to go viral. But aside from this podcast, how do we get the message out to parents that this is absolutely what they should be doing, and what have you been waiting for your whole life?
I think that most parents already heard these messages in their yeshivas and besyakos of MS, trying to be the best person you can be, and to look at things honestly, and to identify negios, which are our underlying biases underneath us, and to ask a rav, talk to your rav, talk to your rabbi, talk to rebbeim, talk to experts. You know, the Torah is all about asking the rofim. You should ask the rofim. And I know post-COVID, everyone's, yeah, you can't believe anything. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, it's very tough. If you love your kid, right, and you're someone who seeks truth, ask the experts. Find out, who does your rav trust? Who does your personal doctor trust? And if it doesn't align with your preconceived notions, I wonder where the problem really is, right? And again, I'm not poo-pooing it in the sense that, like, why can't everyone just get on meds? Yeah, it's not an easy decision. The reason why it's not an easy decision is because anything internal, anything that has vulnerabilities and anxieties and deep fears, is not an easy decision. It really, really is not easy. And I know that. But it's at least simple in the sense that find out. Ask people you trust. Don't just go on the chat boards on thing or, well, my cousin one time had it and made her a zombie. And the other one, he once told someone and then she dumped him right away, right? Like, let's try to take this seriously. When you look up your heart medication, do you go onto the chat boards for that? Do you ask your cousin Yike and just go with whatever she says? No, come on, right? You give your kids a chance. Do what's best for them. You give them Advil. You give them this. You're on Klonopin. You're on Lipitor. Like, come on. You're on medications. It's all the same big pharma. You trust them. You don't trust them. How can you trust them for this, but you don't trust them for that? Like, come on, guys. It's just not worth not looking into it.
Is that what you tell your clients' parents? They come in. Nope.
I don't. I'm all politically correct. It's your choice. Whatever you want. Your body, your choice.
So now when all your clients' parents listen to your podcast, they'll know what you really feel.
They know what I really feel. They're not stupid. It's just that I know, and I think you as therapists know this, that people need time to go through their process. And my point that I'm making here is that it's a process. It's not a logical decision. It's a process. It's an emotional decision, and emotional decisions need you to process it. Talk it over with a therapist, talk it over with your rav, talk it over with your doctor. The point is, recognize this is not a logical decision because you're on the wrong side of logic if you think that it's no.
So what are signs? What how does a parent know, you know, to be looking out, my kid might have ADHD, or maybe this is a time to consider medication? What are, you know, obviously you got the stories of the kids lighting their schools on fires.
Great question. A really good question. The answer is, when you feel like you're not being the parent that you want to be, then maybe it's time for you to find out if you need medication. And maybe if your kid does. But the point is that being a parent is very stressful. Being a human being is stressful. Being a human being who's a parent is double as stressful. Being a human being who's a parent of a child who's also struggling to be a human being could be really, really difficult. So whatever you can do to make that life a little bit easier to handle, a little bit more successful, you owe it to both yourself to make your life a little bit easier, and to your child.
But I think we got off of topic of what Yechiel is asking, and that is, how do you know when your child is ready for ADHD meds?
I knew the question. I answered it the way that I think that it should be answered. Because symptoms, Google it, baby. Right? You want to look up a whole list of symptoms, Google it. Right? Really, it's not about the symptoms. It's not about the data. It's about the dynamic. What's going on between you and your child? Are you being the parent that you want to be? Are you being the parent that your child needs you to be? If you're not, you need help. This reminds me of a beautiful question that they asked Rav Reuven Leuchter. He's a big Musternik. He's a Talmud of Rav Wolbe. At the Aguda Mental Health Conference, they asked him, Rebbe, what's the difference between Musser and therapy? And as a Chavetz Chaim guy, I perked right up because I was interested in all the dopamine was rushing. There you go, Yechiel, all over my brain. And I want to know what he's going to answer. And he stroked his beard and he said, Musser is getting greater depth in the things you already know. We all know, right? We all know that. We all know Musar. We all know you're supposed to be doing kibbutz of aim and chesed and kindness and not speak lashon hara. We know that. Musar is to help you get greater depth in that. Therapy is for the stuff you don't yet know, for things that are a little bit beyond your reach right now. If you feel like you're not being the parent you want to be now, reach out for help. It could be a time to go ask someone, ask a professional, and then you could describe the symptoms to them. the diagnostic criteria for parents should be themselves. This is brand new, by the way. I've never said this ever before, Rifki, and your approving smile meant the world to me.
No, I liked it a lot.
In mind, Yechiel, this is from the professor of psychopathology who teaches clinicians how to diagnostically discern between different pathologies. This is not for shortage of not knowing how to describe the diagnostic differentials. This is because this is the real answer.
No, and I appreciate the real. I appreciate the genuineness and the sincerity and the honesty. It's crucial for all of us to hear. And I'm also wondering that what you said could be true about any psychopathology and therapy in general. This is not about ADHD or medication for ADHD. This is saying when there's something up, get professional help and try to figure out what that is.
When you're not being the you you want to be, get help. You deserve to be the best you. If you're not being the best wife, if you're not being the best husband, if you're not being the best father or mother that you want to be, it could be maybe there's something you don't yet know and that you could find out. And therefore, again, because it doesn't have to do with the diagnosis. It doesn't have to do with the label. Why are we labeling people? What, you need to have a label in order for you to get help? Let's say you don't have a label. Now what? You don't deserve help? You don't deserve to live the best you?
It's so interesting that you say, you know, are you being the best parent that you want to be? Because I would have felt that the answer would have been, you know, if you're constantly blaming your child, you know, and you're and this is a pattern, you see a pattern like this, and you know, and but you know your child is a capable kid. That's when you want to ask, like, is there something off? Is my kid just misbehaving, or is there something that my kid needs that he doesn't have?
That's also a great diagnostic criteria. I happen to have this beautiful, hopefully not Pollyannish view of people, that they're very insightful and honest with themselves. I call this DIY, just dig into yourself. That people, you know, they could feel what's going on inside them. I call it the felt sense. Okay, joke on me. But people could feel what's going on inside themselves. And this is also why it comes down to that, my hard line on medication, which is it's an honesty question. You have to ask yourself, what's really stopping me from doing the medication? Would you do that about Band-Aids? Would you do that about aspirin? Would you do that about insulin? Would you do that about heart medicine for your mother? Would you? No, right? So this is an honesty question. And I really believe in people that they have the capacity to be honest, to look inside themselves and feel what's right and feel, are they being the best parent that they want to be?
But don't you think parents also don't know?
What?
Meaning they're nervous. They're not sure.
They're not sure of what?
If this medication, if the medication is what the child needs.
Then you ask a professional. You go to a psychiatrist. You go to a psychologist. You go to someone who knows ADHD or whatever medication your child may need, bipolar or PTSD, whatever it is that your child will need help. And you go to the expert, just like you go to a heart doctor if you're having heart issues.
So when you say being the best parent that you can be, you really mean, am I just sitting here frustrated with my kid and kicking kicking the walls? Or am I actually being a Baal Seichel and saying, what does my child need? And that's what being the best parent you can be is. Because it's not really about being the best parent, because that's so wide range. But it's more like my child is struggling. You know, instead of just going back and forth or being frustrated or whatever, sitting down and saying, what does my kid need?
I do this on every one of my children's birthday. That night, I have an alarm that goes off and I sit down and I go through the camera scroll on my phone of pictures of them since they were born. I'm getting emotional saying it, but it really helps me. I get to tap into this beautiful child when they were still cute and I wasn't annoyed by them. And I get to see them at their innocent, beautiful face and to connect to my feelings when I held them in the hospital for the first time. And it helps me feel like I want to take care of this kid and I want to do what's best for this kid. And then I write down, what does this kid need from me for this year? And I try to be in touch with that feeling that hopefully all of us have felt and haven't yet lost.
I love that idea, the concept of what you're saying, of just reconnecting. We get so distracted, ADHD or otherwise. We get so distracted by the stresses that come along with parenting, by the stresses that come along with navigating my child's behavior in school and struggles and social, whatever it might be. And every kid has them. And parenting is hard. What you're saying is to find the time to pull that away and reconnect at the core with who that child is.
And with who you really are. Yechiel, I'm going to make this point again at risk of beating a dead horse. I tell this to all the parents I work with. This is not about your kid. I don't even have to meet your kid. This is about you and helping you. If you can learn how to self-regulate, if you could learn how to model self-regulation, then you could be the emotional guide for your child to help guide them through life. Everything else they could Google. The only thing they need us for is to feel loved and accepted for who they are and to learn how to they with their unique personality, which is hopefully made up of some of your genetic material, so you may have a leg up on this one. How could they navigate this crazy, crazy world? That's our only job. Everything else they'll learn in school or on Google, our only job is to guide them through life.
I love that. I wish, you know, I feel like we're kind of simplifying it a little bit as if it were just between parent and child, because there is a school involved and a Rebbe involved and expectations involved. And
it is, Rifki, and I like your point, because what you're saying is, yeah, but it's not just between the parent and the child. And you're right. But in the end of the day is, and I heard this great line from someone, I forget who, was it Dan Siegel or Besser von Brokoke, who said, you are your child's best therapist.
Agreed. I mean, not me, but yeah.
But in a sense, we are, right? I think it was Bessel who said this line. He said, parents are the single most powerful mental health intervention known to mankind.
I love that.
You really are. So you, especially if there's a lot of stuff going on in school, especially if there's a lot of drama happening, they need you, this nuclear bomb of mental health and love and support and acceptance, more than anything else in the world.
You basically have to be ready to be your child's case manager in, you know, of life, because...
Weren't you that as soon as you birthed them or made them?
You were, but you don't realize what that job really was until now.
I think, yeah, I agree with that. Because in the beginning, it's really just technical, which is easy stuff. Going to sonograms, blah, 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 easy, right? Giving them little toys and, you know, taking pictures with them when they're cute, easy, right? Then when they start talking back to you, that's when it starts getting hard, because now that's emotional and that's intangible. And it's very hard for us to deal with things that are intangible, just like everyone has a hard time viewing ADHD as an emotional issue and an interest thing. Instead, they just view it as the superficial, like, manifestations of it. And so often in life, we get caught up in the superficialities of life and we don't see what's really going on underneath. And what's going on underneath is that parenting is really an emotional game. It's not about giving them money in their 504 or whatever. I don't know what you guys have, but in New York, we have like a 529 or their college fund, or trying to talk down the tuition committee, right? It's way more than that. It's not just getting the matching clothing and this and that, or ties for Shabbos. It's about guiding them through this world, being their emotional guide. That's what we're here for. You want to hear a beautiful vart on this? Anyone interested? We know in Bereshis it talks about that Yitzchak was the first baby who was weaned. Apparently, right? But till then, right? Chazal say that people kind of just did their own thing, and kids kind of just grew up on, they were born like animals, like just developed already, able to like kind of scurry off and get their own food. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu made Yitzchak the first infant, the first person to go through infancy. And the reason why was because Avram Avinu was the first person with the Mesorah to give over. And that's what infancy is there for. Childhood is there to make us dependent upon our children so that we can learn from our parents a Mesorah, a derech for life. And that's our job. And too often we outsource it to schools and yeshivas and hopefully not, but sometimes unfortunately TikTok, right? And really that's our role. That's our role, is to be the Baal HaMesorah, to really provide them with the direction and hashkafa and how to lead life. And that's why they're children. That's why Hashem gives them cute cheeks. That's why, like, this is why, so that we could take care of them. This is why they spit up all over us. This is why they leave poop everywhere. This is why they get into fights and draw all over our super fancy, just bought $2,500 artwork, right? This is why, so that you could give them a Mesorah, not so that you could stand there in a gown that barely fits you at the wedding.
This is so nice, and it's such beautiful words that you're saying. It's beautiful, beautiful words. I wish it were as easy for everybody to come away from this thing. Yeah, that's what we got to do. But it's really beautiful. I wish it were easy. I wish it were easy for parents to interact, even myself.
Right, I really wish it was, but then what would be the big cunts? Like, then what's the point? Like, I'm saying big whoop then.
No, you're framing it in a different way, which I think is really important. And I wish we could all come away with that understanding of, this is on you. You're the parent. You're the parent's, you know, you are the guide of the child for life, no matter what happens to the child, good, bad, ugly or otherwise.
Off the derech, on the derech, sick, healthy, from, not from.
You know, you are the emotional guide for the parents. And if you recognize that right away, or, you know, as soon as you can recognize that, or if it's drilled into your head enough times, then it really could reframe a lot of things for a lot of parents.
Yeah, I like the phrase, when we accept that mantle of responsibility. It's something we have to accept. It needs a certain nasa v'nishma. We have to accept it upon ourselves. But I was smiling as you were talking before at Yechiel, who was probably confused on why I was smiling at him, because he made a comment in the previous podcast about when I was talking about my life. He said, wow, it sounds like you're super intense. What about people who aren't so intense? What do they do? How do they become, how do they master their ADHD? I kind of said a point that I want to repeat here, which is, yep, I am intense. Because that's the only way to do it. If you go back to the CNUs, that's the only way to do it. You have to manufacture that interest. You have to make it stimulating. You have to make it a way to turn your brain on. If you're not going to turn your brain on, then yeah, you may just float through life, grasping at straws, talking to this Rebbe, going to that Makobel, paying that therapist, right? And you're never going to get where you really need to be, which is back home, realizing that it's all on you. Ein hadavar tali ela bi. It's on us. And with an ADHD brain, right, which I always say is a kal v'chomer for a neurotypical brain, what works to turn our brain on and to get us moving is to stimulate ourselves, to manufacture our own stimulation. No one else is going to do it for you unless they want something from you, right? So the only one who's going to do that lishma for yourselves is you. Ein hadavar taloi ela bi. It's on us. It's the same thing for personal success as it is for parenting success. We have to recognize it's on us. And if we don't gamify our parenting, if we don't gamify the way that we interact with our life, or even davening or chesed or anything like that. And I don't mean that you give yourself little tokens and stuff like that. I mean, if you don't manufacture interest, if you don't turn yourself on for it, yeah, it's going to be pretty hard to do. But you know what it says in Shema that hopefully all of us say every day? What if I'm not feeling it? How many of us have heard that? But I'm not feeling it, Mom. What if you're not feeling it? The Kadosh Baruch Hu clearly expects that we have the ability and capacity to manipulate our feelings. We can create love with our entire heart. We could be Rabbi Akiva. We could let ourselves be burned and smile and with the joy of finally being able to love HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We could do that. It's in all of us. The Torah isn't just for Rabbi Akiva. It's for every single one of us.
You know, I could see manufacturing that, like, just from a practical standpoint, manufacturing that at home for your kid, you know, making it interesting, making the subject interesting, however you're going to do it. But when the kid is sitting in class and the teacher cannot manufacture that, then the kid is sitting in class after class after class all day. And what do you say to that kid? How do you approach that situation?
Very good question. The first thing you do is you put your arm around your own child and you say, this is really tough. It kind of blows to be in a class where it's pretty boring. I hated sitting through boring classes. And then you pause and you let that sink in, because that's your job. To be their emotional guide. And just like we need our friend to listen to us when we're having a tough time, we should do that too. Not just because we're modeling for this child, but because our child's a human being also, who also may need a second for something to digest and not have us ram down their throats some brilliant, helpful tool you heard on a podcast. So that's the first thing you do, is you put your arm around your child and you say, wow, this is really tough. And then you pause. After you take a deep breath and you fight yourself to keep that pause longer than like half a second, then you could say, what do you feel about that? This is what I call, very eloquently, put the ball in their court. It's their life. The earlier we empower them with autonomy and agency, the sooner they'll start feeling good about themselves, that they have some sort of control over their own life. And you say, how do you feel about that? And you're not here to do a therapy session where you go, yeah, let's unpack that, yeah. You're not doing that. What you're doing is you're just letting your kid feel. In fact, they may even need your help, considering the age of the child, for you to help them label those feelings. Could it be that it's feeling like frustrating? Could it be that it feels like annoying or just unfair? Like, what are any of these feelings sound like it could be happening? Right? You may have to label it for them. They may not have the same articulation and vocabulary, internal vocabulary as we do. But hey, that's our job, to teach them an internal vocabulary, to teach them what's going on inside. You see how it's all coming down to the same idea? After you do that, right, and you help process those feelings, then you could ask them, so what do you want to do about it? If the kid says, I don't know, which is usually the first response, then you say, yeah, it is really tough. Do you want me to share with you some cool stuff about how to get our brain to work? Yeah. You see this toy over here? What do you like about it? Oh, I like that when I push it, it makes noise. Yeah. Right? Or hopefully, like, they don't answer that when they're 14. But, like, when they're older, right, you pick, obviously, an age-appropriate example. You say, like, what do you like about this thing? Or what's something that's exciting for you? Right? You help them see it in a real practical way and say, are there, like, do you know why that is? And then you unpack that for them, show them, oh, so the reason why this, you know, always grabs your brain or why you like that is because, and then whichever active ingredient it is, either because it's challenging or competitive, new or novel, urgent or stimulating, you show them that. And you let them think about that and let that settle. And then when you can, you could show them or get excited when they show you other parts of their lives where they start noticing these ingredients, these active ingredients. And then after some time, you can say, hey, what do you think about trying to like make something interesting in art? Could we make a game, me and you? Is there something we could do where you could recreate that? Right? Just me and you here, I'll help you. What do you think? Should we make like a, I don't know, like a card game, like something like that? Work them through where they can create some sort of manufacture, some sort of interest. And then when your child is sufficiently capable of doing that, right, this is called scaffolding, right? You can then ask them, hey, you have any interest? Is there anything else that's like annoying or boring in your life that you wish that we could kind of make exciting and fun like this? And if they can't, they can say, could I offer a suggestion? Do you think this would help with Mrs. Schneebly's class? What do you think of that? Nah, I don't know how to do that. Yeah, that would be tough, but what do you think? Should we give it a shot? Do you think it could help? Right? And then you work it out together. You don't know Mrs. Schneebly's class. You've never sat there, right? And well, some of us have sat through that. But like, it's probably different than when we were there, especially if she's still teaching that class. So you could ask the child, listen, I don't know the class so well. Can you tell me what the class is like? Walk me through it. And let's see if we could find times to make it. Like, where are the parts that just get boring and annoying for you? And let's kind of identify them together. Already, this is giving your kid a certain sense of control. You're creating a mental mind map of like what's happening in their life. And you're really being, get this, their guide. Imagine if you had that in your life. Imagine if you could do that to your husband. I'm sorry. If you could get your spouse to be able to figure out how to do the things you want him to do by making it exciting. So ladies, yes, it is possible. You could do this to your men. Just we have to be a little more sophisticated.
Oh, no comment.
I mean, it obviously sounds very easy when you're saying it here, but it may, I mean, everything you're saying.
Yeah, these are one of those things that I say, please try this at home, folks.
Right, right. No, but it sounds, I mean, it's amazing. It's so insightful. And
if I could add one caveat, just so that everyone knows, even if you never get to the end where you come up with like some brilliant plan that actually works, you know, and you're going to have to probably switch it up every now and then because it'll get boring after like 2 weeks or even 3 days, right? But the point is, even just going through any of these steps of the process is you engaging in with your child. It's you guiding your child. It's you being there for your child. It's you advocating for your child and giving them the gift of autonomy, giving them the gift of insight. So there's success in every single step of that process.
This is absolutely the truth.
Very common for parents to assuage, I think is the word, their own anxiety by trying to shove a label down the kid's head so that we could feel like now they'll think that they're smart because we've told them they're smart. And there's truth to that. We know that from Joseph Goebbels, right? I think that's his name, the head of Nazi propaganda, which is that if you repeat a lie often enough, people will believe it's true. Unfortunately, you can't compete with the propaganda in his head, which is, I suck, I'm stupid, I suck, I'm stupid, because you're never going to say it as many times as he said, I suck. So really, I feel like that's a very beautiful, well-intentioned coping mechanism for our own anxiety. But really what could be effective would be asking him, hey, what are things you are good at? Let's unpack that together. Let's break down what the core skills of these things that you're good at. Hockey. You're good at hockey. Let's see. What does it take to be a goalie? You have to be able to see things, size up the entire field, be able to track who's going where. All right. Ooh, that sounds tough. All right, let's see if we could do that in Gemara. All right, so let's go. We're trying to track the field. We got this block. Who's coming down the lane, right? So we got Abaye. Abaye is saying this. He's dribbling the puck. All right, and what's Rava doing? Defensive action right there. Sweet. All right, so now it's, you see how it's a totally different like conversation? And it's based in the reality of that he knows already, that he feels in his own body. This is the point of the whole podcast, is that it's all an internal struggle. Nothing's, there's no like tools and tricks to do it. It's all inside us. It's going to be hard to then breathe this out after the session is over. And, okay, that makes sense. I'm allowed to be anxious. Wow, I have a really tough job as a parent and it served me well till now. So it makes sense that I've been anxious. Do I still want to be doing that? I guess not. I don't know. I'll try to do something different. What do I want to do different? And going through this own process with yourself, I think, is a beautiful, deeply moving experience because it takes you to be brutally honest with yourself. And that's really the struggle of being a great parent, is being honest with ourselves. How many people want to listen to them? Not many.
I think that is very powerful.
What's striking me, I'll just tell you like this, what's striking me the most about everything you're saying, Dr. Felt, is that we've heard a lot of, okay, we try to manage this, and a lot of try to compensate with other strengths. And what you're saying is
finding ways for the kid to feel their strengths, what I call the felt sense. Let them feel their strength. Let them feel their own strengths. Because again, the body keeps score. The body knows. They know what message, what they're feeling in class. They feel like a loser and an idiot, right? And so what we could do is, the only way is to fight feelings with feelings. All the words in the world, right? Just calm down! Yeah, when's the last time that ever
happened? Help them generate their own positive feelings about themselves. Amazing. Dr. Felt, thank you as always.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Mental Health Matters. Keep an eye out for the next episode as we continue the conversation about the mental health topics that you need to know. Don't forget to subscribe so you can make sure you catch every episode. See you next time.